the conqueror writes history. They came, they conquered, and they wrote. Now, you don't expect people who came to invade us to write the truth about us. They will always write negative things about us. And they have to do that because they have to justify their invasion in all the countries.
The voice of Miriam Makeba in an interview in 1969. In this interview, among many other musings, Mama Africa reflects on some of the absurdities that were propagated as history, such as that Africans had no history, or that they only step into existence upon their discovery by Europeans. She pushes back against some of the myths that have been woven together with fact to create what we today call history. I, for one, remember my primary school teachers in Zimbabwe telling me that David Livingstone discovered the Mosiwatunya, which he renamed the Victoria Falls. That the majestic natural phenomenon already had a name was an irony that seemed lost to them. Zimbabweans themselves, they taught me and my classmates that Europe brought modernity, and perhaps not in those words exactly, that we were to be thankful for it. We learned that Columbus discovered the New World, which one would assume was old to the people who lived there. And when settlers arrived in that new world, they all had a peaceful feast of Thanksgiving with their friendly new neighbors. These are some of the stories we've been told. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. There's no denying that the world as we know it today is far from perfect. We're facing the greatest threat humankind has ever seen in the form of climate change. According to the United Nations, despite all our advances, our contemporary technology, and a fast-growing billionaire class, almost 10% of the world, or around 700 million people, live in extreme poverty. All across the world, the last years have seen an increase in calls for racial equality. Economically, the world is divided along an invisible line, which is sometimes called, somewhat arbitrarily, developed and developing nations, or the global north versus the global south. Essentially, there are some countries that are wealthy and some that are not. But was this always the case? And if not, how did it come to be? How did race come to be such an important social factor? Here at the State of Power podcast, we're interested in how power functions, how it mutates, and how it shapes the world around us. We believe that if we are to understand the present, we need to put it in its proper historical context and try to understand the historical processes that have led us here. And this is how Roger comes in. Our guest on the podcast today, Roger van Swanenburg, is the founder of Pluto Books, an independent publisher of radical left-wing nonfiction books. He's written a new global history called Wealth and Power, which he's also sharing in a series of blogs online, a link to which you can find in the podcast description. Roger's book traces the roller coaster story of the past 500 years or so of human history, focusing on how Europe and its offshoots amassed great wealth and power at the expense of the rest of the world. Meant for popular reading, the book focuses on how we have created today's world, which we all take for granted. Roger insists that the world we live in is unique in world history. He ponders the question of how Europe, a small and rather insignificant part of the world in 1500, became so powerful and dominant across the globe by 1900. And he brings out the mechanisms that were used to establish European dominance. His motivation, he tells me, is that much of what has been told as history glorifies Europe, and there are few global histories that focus on the impact on the colonized societies.
What was missing, to my mind, was to examine the history from the side of the people who were colonized rather than from the colonizers' point of view.
Roger is critical of the way historians describe the world Europe has created as modern.
Because always the words of the historians, they use again and again the word modern. And what they mean is good, and they mean themselves. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, for a long time, that this concept of modern was never defined. And from the point of view of the people on the receiving end, it's very troubling, because it means they're not modern, they're old. And that's not the case, and we need to understand history better. So I wrote the history with an intention of trying to show what it was like from the recipient's end, rather than from the people who were involved in colonization and violence.
With this in mind, we thought it might be helpful to retrace the history that has led us to the present day, even if this may entail going over what many may consider basic facts. But as we will find out, how we tell history has a great impact on how power operates in today's world. What follows is my conversation with Roger. For details that arise in our talk, such as dates and such, I refer you to Roger's blog, worldandpower.org. We began with Columbus and his search for a new route to India.
Columbus sailed across the Atlantic from Spain by mistake and came across the Americas. And from that time onwards, the Europeans, and it was mainly the Europeans, colonized the rest of the world in bits and pieces. They colonized the Americas from the 1500s to roughly for the next 250 years. And during that time, of course, they set up plantations in the Americas. Mm-hmm. And it was only after the 13 American colonies rebelled and took control of the territory that they had colonized that the Western nations changed their focus to Asia. Mm-hmm. So the colonization of the world, which ended up nearly complete, and I could go through the dates of it all, by 1914, there was really only the parts which we call the Middle East, which had not been colonized in some shape and form. And by 15 years later, it included all of that area as well. So colonization was the central part of the policies of the aggressive nations from Europe. And by the early 19th century, they had been joined by Japan and North America. So the wealth that created the Industrial Revolution came from the rest of the world. And very crudely, if I can say so here, colonization impoverished every country that it came to. And the intention was to move the wealth from the colonies to the European and latterly the Americas and Japan. It was the British, the French, and the Dutch, and latterly the Germans, who were heavily involved in this process. In essence, that's what happened.
When these voyages of discovery happened, were they initially benevolent explorations, voyages of finding new people and perhaps creating diplomatic relations? Or was the logic of expropriation, plunder, inherent at the beginning of this expansion of Europe?
The answer is it was for none of these reasons. Mm-hmm. It's used as voyages of discovery in the West today, but it wasn't that at all. It was to do with the silk trade. And if you excuse me just for a second, the major global trade for hundreds of years was from the east to the west. And every part of today's Middle East, Egypt and Europe benefited in some way or another from the silk trade. When the Ottomans took control of what is today Turkey, they then shut off the routes for the Europeans to benefit from the silk trade. Mm-hmm. And so what the Spanish and the Portuguese were trying to do was to find their own ways to Asia so that they could continue the silk trade. Mm-hmm. And that's why this so-called voyage of discovery across the Atlantic occurred. They were trying to find a back passage to Asia. And when they arrived, they didn't know where they were. And they came across peoples who they couldn't recognize totally as human beings because they weren't Christian. And so they went back to the Pope and asked him what they should do. Mm-hmm. And the Pope told them in no uncertain words that they should enslave them.
So this is the doctrine of discovery.
This is the doctrine of discovery. That's right.
The doctrine of discovery established a spiritual, political, and legal justification for colonization and seizure of land not inhabited by Christians. It was made by a series of decrees by the Pope, granting Christians a monopoly of trade with newly discovered lands and authorizing the enslavement of the local people.
And what they discovered was a civilization which was highly sophisticated. And they didn't use gold for exchange. They used gold as a soft metal, which they could produce all kinds of objects from. Mm-hmm. And the invaders took the gold and then tried to create gold mines in the areas to create more gold. And there was a surplus of gold coming back from Central America. Mm-hmm. Into Europe, which was then used to trade in Asia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the trade to North America was a way of sort of getting currency in the New World and then trading it with the old routes to Asia.
That's right. That's correct.
And so now this, all of this sounds to me like common economic sense at this moment. It's like, these are nations that have been trying to find alternative trade routes. When do we have the introduction of this differentiation between Europe and the rest of the world? You mentioned that they go to the Pope and they say all these people are different, but difference at that time is not necessarily inferiority, is it?
Okay. What they did then was they defeated the peoples that they discovered and enslaved them. And they rapidly died from both diseases and from the business of enslavement. The Europeans quickly found that they couldn't use the local people to work the mines as they would like. And that started the process of bringing slaves from Africa. So they needed a justification for doing what they were doing for themselves as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. And that justification was that the people they'd found there weren't as human as themselves. If you read the words of the time, you can see that very easily. They used what we would now describe as racism. They didn't describe it as racism at the time. They diminished the humanity which they found in order to be able to kill people and to enslave them. And that was the original justification for what we now call racism.
Mm-hmm. I was under the impression, like, for instance, before there were initially respectful engagements, respectful interactions. And then once this new priority to produce in the New World came about, then this dehumanization began. Is that what happened? That's how I understand it.
That is not my reading of it. When peoples who are very strange to each other meet for the first time, there's obvious, both sides are inquisitive to the nature of the human beings that they're seeing. But the people who were in these voyages of discovery were after wealth. They wanted to find new wealth, which they could bring back to Europe. And the idea that there was initial respect and interaction is mistaken.
So the logic of plunder was right at the beginning. It's not even there was a change.
Plunder is the correct word, because the difference between piracy and legitimate trading ships was very small. You have to remember that in the time of the 16th and 17th century, crossing the Atlantic was an enormous endeavor. It was a huge endeavor of seamanship, because the boats were relatively small, and the chances that you might never return was very real. So the idea that you would want to enrich yourself was high on the agenda. And the other way of looking at this is to see the world as it was in Europe at the time. We're dealing with a pre-capitalist world where the opportunities for people enriching themselves were very small. The majority of people probably never traveled more than 10 miles from the place from which they were born. So that the opportunity for increasing wealth was extremely limited.
So you could really only escape the social limitations by
plunder,
focusing outwards.
Yes, and trade was one of them, of course. And people knew about trade because trade had been going on, international trade had been going on for a very long time. And I could spell that out with the city-states of what is now Italy. You can see that very clearly from where the wealth in Europe actually came from. I mean, let me just go sideways slightly on that question of wealth. You would look at Venice, was a city-state. And Venice was part of the international trade across the Mediterranean, getting the trading goods, which were coming up the Red Sea and into Egypt and what are now parts of the Middle East. So trading in Venice was one of the wealthiest parts of the world at the time. And if you travel to Venice today and go into some of the churches, you can wonder at the extraordinary architecture and the wealth that you can see there. And there's no, and if you ask yourself, where does that come from? There's no obvious answer. Unless you understand the silk trade of the day,
so that Venice was a central point in this trade from east to the
absolutely.
West.
Absolutely, they were great boatmen. They built ships. That was the place where was the most wealthy through trade.
And I mean, I've heard some readings. For instance, Cedric Robinson says Venice, being a city-state, had a very static population. And whenever they needed work and all of that, they needed sort of a slavery system to exist, many of the Mediterranean states. So slavery was also not new when they went to the New World. Would you agree with this reading?
Yes. That was right. That was right, yes.
So the logic of using human beings as means to an end was sort of already a thing. And this then was just amplified from these people being very different in looks and different in their worldview, essentially.
Yes. I don't know if you want to get onto slavery yet, but slavery is very old.
Yeah, let's talk about slavery, because for me that seems to be one aspect of human history that is downplayed in terms of its impact on the current world we live in, on the present, and that seems to be sort of there's this element of, well, it happened in the past, didn't have much of an impact. Let's talk about it.
Okay, so well, slavery is very old. You'll find slave, not total slave societies, but you'll find slaves in the kingdoms, in the Middle East. You'll find them in what is today Iraq, for instance. You'll find slavery in China. You'll find slaves everywhere you find. And the slaves, you'll find them trading, in fact. Slavery was very different in many respects to what is our normal concept of slavery as used by Europeans in the Americas. Slaves were often the people who were caught during wars and taken home and then sold to wealthy people. And slaves were the concubines who ran the affairs of emperors. If you went into the Chinese emperor's palaces, it was full of concubines and full of slaves who were running the affairs of the state. Mm-hmm. You find slaves traveling vast distances in the silk trade. You find them all over the place. Mm-hmm. The difference between slavery there and the slavery that was used in the Americas is very significant. Slaves were personal property. Mm-hmm. And as property, let me go one, take one step back. Mm-hmm. One of the things that colonialism brought in was private property. There was no general private property before the colonial era.
So private property as a concept, you say, is something that only came about once we had this colonial era.
It didn't come out of colonialism. It really came out of the religious fervor and changes, which you need to look at Luther and Calvin for that.
Okay, so we won't get into that. But
don't get into that for a moment. But the slaves that were taken from Africa and brought into the Caribbean and into what is now Southern America and into North America were chattel slaves. Chattel slavery is significantly different and needs to be understood as such. Mm-hmm. Human being who was the personal property of the owner had life and death control over that person and had control over their over any children that came out. Mm-hmm. So chattel slavery for the people who were involved removed their social life almost entirely. Children were sold on once they got to age of 5 to 10 very often, and was of an industrial character. Mm-hmm. And that distinguishes it from the slavery which you find in the pre-industrial world.
Mm-hmm. Where you see that before you had this slavery in this form, that slaves could perhaps grow to positions of influence and perhaps even become freedmen afterwards, children were not automatically slaves.
There's no question that slaves in the old societies could in some respect achieve, become generals, become important people and so on. And you find that sort of slavery across the world for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. In chattel slavery, that wasn't possible.
Yeah.
Chattel slavery were people who had a life expectancy probably of 5 years, maybe 10 years from the time that they arrived, and if they arrived in the in North America.
So this is, we're talking here about a very violent system, a very specific form of violence as well. And in your book, In Wealth and Power, in the blogs also that I've been reading, you really talk about this violent impact of the colonizing countries on the societies that they got to interact with. This slavery is I think the distilled version of this violence. But could you explain more broadly what were the impacts of this new interaction?
Let's just focus on the violence of the New World, of the North America. What happened over a period of 250 years was the extermination of the existing people from not all, but nearly all of the Americas. They reckon that in North America alone, there was somewhere between 45 and 90 million people. This is the original indigenous population. And they were wiped out. It was really the first and possibly the largest ever removal of a people from the face of this earth that we have ever seen. Today it's played down in North America, not unnaturally, but I think it needs to be seen as the first major Holocaust that we use, and that is using the word Holocaust in the meaning of the word as it was defined after 1945 in the United Nations. But people were exterminated. They caught the diseases of the Europeans, and the Europeans helped those diseases to be among the people. And so the entire scope of what is today the USA, the peoples were just destroyed. And it is little difficult to get your head around just what horror that actually is. And one of the reasons why the USA is today the most powerful nation in the world is that when they started to industrialize at the beginning of the 19th century, they didn't have an old society to get rid of. As
the old society had been wiped out already.
The old society had been wiped out. And that understanding ought to be, in my view, the beginning of the understanding of the USA.
So would you call the United States in the present day a colony?
No.
Because this is a conversation I've been having with folks. It's like, well, the United States, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, these are considered white countries. These are majority European extraction societies.
Yes. But
there were people that were originally there, and most of these current majority came from elsewhere. So are they colonies?
All those four societies, the people were wiped out. There's a number of them left, of course. They didn't completely wipe them out.
Yeah.
But they are such a small minority today. I think very important minority. But essentially, these areas of land were, how can I say properly, they simply removed the indigenous people from their existence. And this, by any state, by any idea, are holocausts. And that's the origin of these societies today.
Yeah, this is a very, like when you think about the enormity of what you're saying, for me, what it comes down to is sometimes I feel people don't acknowledge just how heavy those occurrences were, that people don't understand that it was actually entire civilization wiped off the face of the planet.
That is why when I started this conversation, I said we have created a world which is quite extraordinary and unlike any that has ever been seen in history before. Mm-hmm. And this is part of that explanation.
Mm-hmm. And so this world that we've created, let's come to the present in a way and look back at all these things that you've mentioned. I'd spoken at some other point about, for instance, the racial wealth gap within societies. Like if you look at South Africa, if you look at the United States, if you look at the United Kingdom, there is a wealth gap, and then it has a very racial characteristic. So how has the ideology of racism lasted for so long? And how has it kind of maintained this wealth separation?
Okay.
It seems to be actually growing in an era where science has proved that we only have one human race. We have racism as a huge element of today's society. What should we learn from this history? How can we use that to help us today?
Okay. Let me answer that and relate it to what I have been saying. People who do the horrific acts which I have really only touched on need justification to see themselves as human. We all need to see ourselves as human. And therefore, we need to find a set of ideas which we take for granted that we are somehow superior to others.
Mm-hmm.
And the racism which justified the original killings of the peoples of today's Central America were justified on that the white invaders were superior to others.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of superiority, of being the master race.
Mm-hmm.
And although only Germany ever called itself the master race, the British and the Dutch and the French behaved as if they were the master race. And they saw themselves as the master race. And if you really grasp that concept and realize that the Europeans thought this for 450 years, and that's very difficult to actually grasp. But when you hear people like the leaders, like Churchill, which is a man who's venerated by, I suspect, 90% of the people in the UK, he was utterly a racist. And if you read the words, he assumed that the Palestinians, for instance, were a lesser people, and the Jews were a superior people, and therefore the Jews had a right to Israel. Churchill said that. It was assumed right the way through until the 1950s that the Europeans were a superior people.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very well when I first set out as a young man at the age of 20. And as I was leaving, my mother said to me, "Roger, always remember you're British." And what she meant by that was always remember that you come from a superior race. That was what was underneath her statement. And this idea of being a superior peoples have become part of the national acceptance right the way through white societies in Europe and America and so on. So it's not surprising that the wealth difference between them today is what it is. And it is also not surprising that the ideas of racism have spread right the way through the societies to the poorest of white people, who still think that they are superior to people of any color whatsoever.
The more I read history, the more I get into it, the more I think, well, we tend to think that history was so far away, but it's really just yesterday, and its impacts are really being felt till present day.
But it's not just yesterday. It's today.
It's today.
the movement that you've just seen on the 6th of January, which was the attempt by a white group of people to invade the Congress in America. Behind that movement is the belief that the white people of America should rule America. And that America, North America, the USA in particular, because of their removal of their indigenous people and because they enslaved very large numbers of people on their own lands, possibly has the deepest roots of racism than anywhere else in the world.
The right of conquest, we conquered this land, it is ours.
Yes.
And this demographic shift that's pushing us out of power has to be stopped.
Exactly. And so that's why I was trying, why I have been trying to write this book, is to get these ideas across in a way which people can understand.
Yeah. This history that we've just spoken about, what implications does it have for the present day? How can we use it? And what insight does it give us going forward?
That is
a difficult question, I know.
That is a very difficult question. The first thing is that people, I think, need to understand history as it really was, not as the invaders would like it to be seen. If we're ever going to come to terms with our society, if we're going to have to come to terms with the nature that we have been exploiting, and to live a decent society for all of us, then we need to understand this history, because we can't go back and change it.
Yeah.
It was as it was. And there's a potential wonderful future if we understand our relationships with each other and our relationships with the world, which is actually nature, amongst us. And all religion has always been an understanding of these, the human beings' relationship to the rest of the world and human beings' relationships to each other. That's the core of all religions. And we need, again, to remember that this is the core of living and of humanity, and that there is a great future if we can use what we know to each other's benefit. So my feeling is that a good understanding of history can lead to a decent future for everybody. And that's what really why I'm trying to write this, because it seems unless we come to terms with the past, we can't really produce that sort of future that we want.
Wow, thank you so much.
Human history is like a tapestry with many different strands woven together. The privileging of only one of those strands has created a monochrome, monotonous fabric. It has impoverished the world, both tangibly and in spirit and thought. Until we dare to look history in the face and deal with its unsavory reality, true progress towards a beautiful future will be nothing but false hope. Thank you for listening this far. I've been your host, Sean Macheza, in conversation with publisher and historian Roger van Swanenburg. Roger's book is available from Pluto Publishers, and a link to his blog is included in the podcast description. This episode is the first of three on global history in conversation with Roger. The next two will be on colonialism and the lessons of history for the contemporary world. Don't miss out. If you're looking for another interesting podcast to listen to, check out the Exalt podcast. The Global Extractivisms and Alternatives Initiative is a new international network of scholars, activists, and policymakers who are dedicated to collaboration and knowledge creation around the pressing crisis from extractivist policies and practices. I particularly like the episode with Barry Gills, who focuses on extractivism and socio-ecological radical transformation. You can find a link in the description. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please do send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.